From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. For the past 25 years, former New Hampshire U.S. Senator Warren Rudman has made national leaders sit up and listen, even when, in fact, especially when they don't want to. During his 12 years in the Senate, Rudman was seen as a bipartisan player, a sometimes gruff, sharp thinker who'd tell it to you straight, often called the conscience of the Senate. But while respected in office, Rudman's voice became amplified even more after he left politics in 1992. When thorny issues bedeviled politicians and they decided a high-level study commission was needed, chances were good they looked to Rudman. He served on President Clinton's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board. He headed a commission probing Gulf War illness. He co-founded the Concord Coalition, the leading national voice for deficit reduction, and he co-chaired with former Senator Gary Hart a bipartisan study of national security, whose predictions 2 years before 9/11 were chilling after the reality of that day. In their report, Rudman and Hart said without a vigorous recommitment to homeland security, Americans will likely die on American soil, possibly in large numbers. In an interview on The Exchange a few months after September 11th, Rudman discussed his report and how devastated he was to hear his own grim forecasts coming true.
I walked out of my apartment that morning in Washington at about 8:30, and then the report came about what had happened. And before I got to my office, the second plane hit.
Yeah.
And at that point, no criticism intended, the broadcasters weren't sure themselves what was going on. I mean, how could two airplanes get that far off course and a beautiful day and crash into the Twin Towers? But of course, as soon as I heard about the second one, I said to myself, my God, we were right. Only it happened faster than I thought it would.
Today in The Exchange, Warren Rudman joins us as our 25 in 25 series continues. We're celebrating NHPR's quarter century on the year by highlighting those people who've shaped our state, and in Rudman's case, our nation. Let's get your questions in, too, today. Call in at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Senator Rudman joins us from a studio in Washington. Senator Rudman, great to have you back on The Exchange. Thanks for your time.
Well, good morning, Laura. It's great to be with you on NPR, New Hampshire Public Radio.
Well, and as I said, we're celebrating our 25th birthday this year. Senator Rudman, where were you 25 years ago?
Well, I was just starting my first Senate term. I had run for election in the fall of 1980 and took the oath of office on January 3rd, 1981, and I believe that is the year that NPR New Hampshire became a reality.
And what was it like running for U.S. Senate back then, Senator Rudman? Probably different than it is now a quarter century later.
Well, it was different in the sense that although there was a lot of money spent, it was nothing like it is today. I ran in a very crowded field of 10 or 11 people, I believe, in the primary, and then against an incumbent Democrat, John Durkin, in the general election. I would say that the campaigns were, although there was some negativity on both sides of that campaign, they tended to be a little bit more rational than some of the nasty, negative campaigns of today. And I think things have really deteriorated in terms of the quality of campaigns since that time.
10 people in the primary.
That's right.
That's
and it was some pretty high-level people. Former governor John Sununu was in there. Former state senator David Bradley. Former governor Wesley Powell. And an assortment of other people who were not that well known, but it was a highly contested primary. And, of course, in New Hampshire, you don't have a runoff. Whoever gets the largest number of votes wins, and I was fortunate to beat out John Sununu, who later, of course, I supported, and he became governor 2 years later.
How do you think you made yourself stand out in that very crowded field?
Well, I'm not sure. That's probably for others to judge. I think that people got to know me when I was Attorney General of New Hampshire from 1970 to 1976 as being pretty direct. You described as blunt, sometimes gruff. I think that's all accurate. I think the people of New Hampshire do enjoy straight talk. I've always taken things on head on, even though I knew that people disagreed. And I think to some extent that directness helped me a great deal. In addition to that, there's no question that being Attorney General of the state during six very tumultuous years elevated my profile in the minds of the people of the state. And I think I did have some advantage over others in that primary, certainly not over the former governors, but Governor Wesley Powell, who had been governor many years before, but the others were not probably as well known as I was.
Again, our number on the exchange is 1-800-892-6477, and it's our 25 and 25 series. It continues today in the exchange with former New Hampshire U.S. Senator Warren Rudman. Well, Senator Rudman, you do have a reputation for being direct and kind of hitting people on the head even when they don't want to be. One of the biggest issues that you tackled early in your Senate career was deficit reduction, the Graham Rudman Hollings Deficit Reduction Act, which got a huge amount of attention at the time. I certainly remember it. Why was this such an important piece of legislation, Senator Rudman?
It was important because at that point we were heading towards record deficits under a conservative Republican president, Ronald Reagan, and we did control the United States Senate, although not the House, and I found it totally unacceptable that we were going to load all of this debt on our children and our grandchildren. And in 1985, when it came time to raise the borrowing limit of the United States, Phil Graham and Fritz Hollings and I put together a very creative piece of legislation, which essentially said, look, you can spend anything you want to spend, but you either have to cut in other places or raise taxes. You know, do whatever you want to do, but we're not going to keep borrowing money from the Japanese, the Saudis, now the Chinese, most of Europe, and make our children carry a tax burden that's going to be onerous. It worked very well for 4 or 5 years until it became too difficult for people to make those difficult decisions. And out of that, of course, came the Concord Coalition when I left the Senate, which I formed with Paul Tsongas, and we still continue that fight. The issue is still in front of us. We are facing fiscal calamity out, you know, 8, 10, 15 years, and I continue to think that issue and the issue of global warming are the two biggest issues facing future generations of this country.
Well, and how hard was it to get this bill passed, Senator Rudman? I mean, in a way, it seems very reasonable. You can't spend it unless you have the money.
Well, you know, it was hard, but in the final analysis, you know, we had a pretty good strategy. We knew that people were going to have to vote to increase the debt limit, which is an onerous thing to do. So we gave them something that would give them some cover. We said, yeah, you'll have to vote for that, but here you can vote for a piece of legislation that's going to hopefully guarantee it's not going to keep happening in the future. And of course, to the liberals, it meant it might cut defense spending. And to the conservatives, it meant it might cut social spending. And so there was something in it for everybody. It passed both houses of Congress overwhelmingly, with both Tip O'Neill in the House and Ted Kennedy in the Senate voting for it, who certainly were icons of the liberal establishment at that time. So it was kind of something for everybody, and it worked pretty well for a few years. But then people started to run away from it. We're kind of back in the soup again.
Well, your colleague on this, Phil Graham, likened it to diets. He said, diets and deficit reduction plans have one thing in common. It's the ones that work that we quit because they're just too hard.
That's exactly right. And I think none of us had any illusions that it might work forever, but we thought it was a good start. And by the way, it did start the first serious ongoing discussion in the Congress about the deficit, and that continues until today.
Well, and as you said, your involvement in this issue led you to co-found the Concord Coalition with the late Paul Tsongas. That group is still alive and kicking today.
Very much so.
But how much do you think Senator Rudman people are listening?
Oh, I think they are. As a matter of fact, our staff and the Comptroller General of the United States, Government Accountability Office, David Walker, Director, were up in New Hampshire last week, as you may know, and we're doing what we call a fiscal wake-up tour across the country.
Yes, I heard about that.
All on college campuses and in various public forum. And the fact is that people are paying attention. It is a great concern to many, many people. The problem is that to try to get action at the national level is extraordinarily difficult because it's an exercise in hard choices, but it's going to be much easier to do it now than when the roof collapses. Then we've got real trouble.
Well, one more question on this, Senator Rudman, and then we have so much else to talk about. But leading up to the Republican Revolution in Congress in 1994, Republicans really focused on the deficit as an issue. Democrats said, you know, oh, as a percentage of GDP, it's not that bad. And then in the last election, the 06 midterms, I interviewed several Republicans and asked them about the deficit. And they said, well, deficits are overblown. They're not really such a big problem. So depending on who's in office, politicians try and say, well, it's really not that big a problem.
Well, you know, I compare it to the Eddie Murphy's movie, Trading Places. The Democrats became Republicans. The Republicans became Democrats. I mean, there's no question in my mind that that as Republicans gained power and were not willing to do something about the deficit, they conveniently adopted, well, it's not that bad. Well, it is that bad. And anybody who looks at numbers will tell you that, you know, my grandchildren who are now, you know, ages 9, 12, and 14, when they get to be in their 30s and 40s, unless we do something radically different, their tax burden is going to be enormous, or we're going to cut benefits severely on people who really need them. I mean, those are the choices.
Our phone number again on the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. The exchange's 25 and 25 series continues today. Our guest is former New Hampshire U.S. Senator Warren Rudman. Senator Rudman, lots of people who want to talk to you. Let's go to some of them. Over to Vermont, actually, first. Brendan's calling from Brunswick, Vermont. Hi, Brendan. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you. Good morning, Senator.
Good morning.
Bren Whitaker, quick introduction. I was Dick Snelling. You remember the late governor?
I knew him very well.
Concord Coalition. I was his natural resources secretary. Several of us up here think, I live right on the New Hampshire border. I'm looking across at the Stratford Peaks, beautiful this morning.
I'll bet.
Forestry is my other background. And we think you didn't get enough credit at the time with working with our Senator, Pat Leahy, back in 88, to put together the whole Northern Forest effort. Now, on 25-25, you've already talked about wide-ranging things, 9/11 and the international stuff and deficit and all, but the whole North Country owes you a great amount of thanks.
You know, Brendan, this is a great question. Go ahead, Senator Rudman. Then I have.
Well, I appreciate that. Let me simply say that, you know, that's an interesting you bring that up because, you know, it's a great example of what we were able to do certainly during the 80s and into the early 90s, and it's changed radically, and that is we could reach across the island and work with people. I am very fond of Pat Leahy, personal friend of mine, very bright man, very, you know, inner-directed. We disagree on a lot of things. We agree on a lot of things. And it was only by getting together that we were able to bring other people into it and get that done. And as you say, it has been very important. And, you know, as far as getting credit, I've never worried too much about that as long as we got the job done.
You know, it raises an interesting point, though. Over 25 years, Senator Rudman, what's your perspective on this whole conservation movement that we've seen in northern New England, preserving tracts of land, you know, recognizing that our landscape is an important part of our culture and our economy here?
Well, it all started back, you know, in the 80s, mm-hmm. In the United States Congress, and it was people like Pat Leahy, myself, and others who were able to put legislation together that your caller has accurately described, which started an entire movement, which in my view is extremely important. I mean, you know, I've lived in the state all of my life. I know northern New England like the palm of my hand. It's an absolutely remarkable place with wonderful natural resources. And you get into the 60s and 70s and people weren't paying attention. Well, we did start to pay attention, and it's made a difference to the quality of life of people who live in our region, and I think that's extremely important.
Let's go next to Rochester, where Matt is waiting. Hi, Matt. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning, Senator.
Morning.
Glad to hear from you. My question is actually involving the Supreme Court. I'm wondering what your opinions are on the politically charged atmosphere at the court and your relationship to Justice Souter today.
Very interesting, Matt. Thanks.
Well, take the last part of your question first. He is probably, there's no one closer than David. We are very close. We stay in constant contact. We try to have a meal or two every month or 6 weeks. We talk a great deal. And he is a very dear friend, and I am very proud of him. And I am just delighted that I was in a position to recommend him to the president for both the Circuit Court as well as the Supreme Court. The court is obviously split. That's not unusual. If you go back in history, there was a recent television series on public television on the Supreme Court, which I highly recommend. People haven't seen it. They try to get copies of it. And it will point out to you that throughout our history, throughout the civil rights movement and many other contentious areas of federal control over certain parts of our economy, there have been enormous splits in that court. So what we see today, we think is different. It really isn't different. There have been those kind of splits, which kind of represent the split that exists in the country and has for many years. But I have great faith in the court, and I think over the years it tends to balance out, and its decisions tend to be in the interests of all of us. And I have great regard for the court, every member of the court, even though I disagree with some of them on some things.
Matt, thanks for the call. And again, if you want to chime in with former New Hampshire U.S. Senator Warren Rudman today in the exchange, you can call in at 1-800-892-6477. What do you remember from the Rudman years as a U.S. senator? How do you think Warren Rudman influenced our state? You can join us 1-800-892-6477. Senator Rudman, it struck me as I was going through the information on your career that your career really kind of took off in a new direction post-U.S. Senate. You became sort of an elder statesman in Washington, serving on commissions
and boards
and so forth.
Yeah, with emphasis on the word elder, Laura, right.
Well, just going to that decision that you made in 92 to not seek re-election, how come and how hard a decision was that?
Well, it really wasn't that hard. I had always internally and to my family said that if I could win a Senate seat and do some things, I would like to serve two terms. I was 50 when I got there, and I was 62 when I left. I wanted to do other things. I wanted to write. I've always enjoyed practicing law. I wanted to do that again, but in a different way than I had in New Hampshire because of the experience I had had. I really felt that I had done a lot in 12 years. I had enjoyed it, made a lot of friends, but two terms was probably enough for me. And so it wasn't hard at all. And I know it came as a great shock to many people in the state who could not imagine why, because I was essentially unopposed for re-election in 1992, and then, of course, when I elected not to run again, Judd Gregg, ran for the seat and won the seat. I just felt that I had many other things I wanted to do with my life, and it turned out that post-Senate, I've done some really interesting things. You mentioned one. One of the most fascinating things I've done was, not only was I a member, but you may not know it, Laura, but I was chairman of the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board, which is an extraordinarily important board, which little is known about, with good reason. And I was the first person of a party opposite of a president to serve as chairman. I mean, Clinton, after all, was a Democrat. I'm a Republican. And it was fascinating, the things that we were able to do and the advice we were able to give the president and how plugged in we were to all the national security crises that were going on. That was an enormously rewarding experience, and I enjoyed it a lot. And of course, the Concord Coalition, National Commission on National Security, 21st Century, your short title, Hart Rudman, which predicted 9/11. I mean, all of those things have been, to me, personally rewarding. And I am 76 years of age, hard to believe, but I'm working as hard today as I ever did, and I think it's probably an omen that if you do that, you're probably going to live longer.
And I want to ask you about a couple of those roles in a moment, but one more question about your Senate career, Senator Rudman.
Yeah.
In your book about your career, it's called Combat.
Right.
Why Combat?
Well, I'll tell you an interesting anecdote. It was called Combat because in many cases the debate on the floor, got pretty intense. And, of course, I had a real combat experience as a rifle platoon leader and company commander in action during the Korean War. And the reason I came up with the title was a very interesting thing that happened one night at the Senate floor. And I'll take a minute and tell you the story. You all know, of course, Senator Bob Kerry of Nebraska won the Congressional Medal of Honor in Vietnam, and someone that I just liked personally immensely. He's now my co-chairman, by the way, of the Concord Coalition. And Bob and I were standing next to each other about 1 in the morning when there was a terrific debate going on the floor. And it was getting nasty and contentious, and it was really pretty bad. And I was kind of smiling, and so was Kerry. And I said to Bob, why are you smiling? He said, the same reason you're smiling. And I said, what's that? He said, because nobody is firing real bullets. And there was a lot in that statement, I thought. And that gave me the inspiration from the title of the book.
So people are combating, but, unlike in some other countries, you can politically debate without killing each
exactly
other.
Right. Exactly. But the Senate can get very contentious, and people who watch C-SPAN are aware of that. I mean, people have very deeply held, very passionate views on subjects with major disagreement. And, you know, that is the way the Founding Fathers intended it. The Senate is a place to be able to debate these issues thoroughly, and that's exactly what happened.
Lots of callers, Senator Rudman. Let's go to Brendan next. He's calling from Webster. Hi, Brendan. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, it's an honor. I remember in the late 80s trading stories about dogs in Doc Gleason's office one morning. It's funny that you mentioned the word statesman a little earlier. Senator, you were a statesman among statesmen. Where are the statesmen now?
Well, unfortunately, there are some, but unfortunately, I'll tell you what I think. I think the campaigns themselves have become so nasty that they've kind of leaked over into the conduct of our affairs in both the House and the Senate. I mean, these campaigns are so negative, they are so scurrilous in some ways, they're so full of lies and blatant distortions that people don't have very good feelings about each other in these bodies. That has changed since I was there. I think it's pretty hard to be a statesman when you come into a body in which some of your best friends have been defeated by, on both sides of the aisle, by scurrilous assaults on their character, their families. Not good. But let me be quick to point out, you know, it's interesting. If you go back and read history, and I'm a history buff, that is my hobby, reading, and I read a lot of history. That's about all I read. You go back, all the way back to the Founding Fathers and to the early days of the Congress, and this is not new. In fact, in some ways, it was worse back then than it is now, some of the scurrilous things that they said about each other. So I guess politics is a contact sport in this country, and pretty hard to have statesmen flourish in that kind of an atmosphere.
Well, and one more question along those lines. In your book, Combat, you said that conservative religious groups had gained way, way too much control in the Republican Party. You call this alliance a terrible mistake.
Oh, I still believe that, and I think that people are certainly entitled to their strongly held personal beliefs, religious, ethical, and whatever. I don't have a problem with that, but I really think that when they start to organize around religious principles and try to impose that on the body politic, I think we're heading for trouble. I mean, you know, as I said in the book, if you want to see the mix of politics and religion and what it gets you, I would suggest you look at Belfast, Bosnia, and Beirut. Yeah, those are my three B's. Those were religion and look at Iraq today. I mean, look at the people who call themselves Muslims but have a different view of the religion, Shia and Sunnis, essentially massacring each other, and it's based on religion. I mean, I don't think religion has any place in politics. I've felt very strongly about that all of my life, and I continue to feel that way.
You made some pretty strong statements in the book about that. What kind of a reaction did you get from your fellow Republicans?
Well, a lot of them agreed with me publicly and many more privately, who live in states where conservative, very ideologue, evangelical Republicans live. And, you know, a lot of people thought I was criticizing them. I wasn't criticizing them. I was criticizing the fact that they were getting mixed up. Their religion and politics shouldn't mix. Now, their values ought to mix, and those come from religion. I don't have a problem with that. But, you know, I had a big problem with Ralph Reed and the Christian Coalition and said so.
We'll take more of your calls after a short break and more conversation with Senator Rudman. We'll also ask him about that report that he co-authored with Gary Hart about terrorism in this country. And your calls, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Support for New Hampshire Public Radio comes from UR members and from Woodstock Inn Station and Brewery, brewing quality handcrafted ale since 1994, featuring Pig's Ear Brown Ale and its newest Pemmy Pale Ale, WoodstockInnBrewery.com. And New Hampshire Credit Union's not-for-profit and member-owned, serving the financial interests of members who live or work in New Hampshire. Information online at gocu.org. More with former U.S. Senator Warren Rudman, part of our 25 and 25 series on The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio, and at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show, What's Behind Rising Tensions in U.S.-Russian Relations. New Hampshire weather, a mostly cloudy day today. Chance of rain with a slight chance of snow showers in parts of the state. Chance of flurries in the north. Highs today mid-20s north and lower 40s south. For tonight, it'll be mostly cloudy. Chance of snow showers. Lows tonight, single numbers in the north, lower 20s in the south.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Friday in The Exchange, we call in our Granite State movie experts to get their picks for the Academy Awards. You can email us your favorites at nhpr.org and see what our reviewers chose, too. Again, the address nhpr.org. That's the place to get ready for our Oscar show tomorrow. Today in The Exchange, our 25 and 25 series continues as we celebrate NHPR's 25th birthday this year with interviews of 25 people who shaped our state over the past quarter century. Now today, former U.S. Senator Warren Rudman joins us. He's a Republican who served in the U.S. Senate from 1981 to 93. Let's get your questions and comments in for Senator Rudman. 1-800-892-6477. Whether it's the state of politics today, some of the major issues that he's worked on, deficit reduction, homeland security, or your memories from the Rudman years in the U.S. Senate. All calls are welcome at 1-800-892-6477. Senator Rudman, before we go back to the phones, as we said before the break, you and Senator Hart gained huge attention after 9/11 for your report on weak homeland security 2 years before the attacks. How is the nation doing now on this issue of homeland security, going on 6 years after 9/11?
Well, we're doing a lot better, but we're not doing what we ought to be doing in some areas. For instance, the ability of police and emergency units and fire units to talk to each other on the same communication frequencies is still not universal across the country, and not even in the large cities. I think that's regrettable. I think New Hampshire's made some pretty good progress in that area, and I think we're much better off than we were, but I am still fearful that we are still vulnerable. And, you know, we'll always be vulnerable. There is no way to have a 100% solution that will guarantee that no terrorists can act in the United States. But we can do a great deal to cut down the odds. And I think we are doing a great deal, and I think it's been improving over the last few years.
Well, give us some of the biggest examples of what you can do, as you said, to cut down the odds. I mean, ports, for example, are often cited.
Yeah, that is actually number one on my list. I mean, the number of cargo containers and millions that come into our ports and are not inspected, that is changing slowly, but it is changing. I feel that we spent too much money on airline security and not enough on port security and transit of all kinds. I think it's important that where people tend to congregate and travel, that all of the technology that can be brought to bear on those issues ought to be, and ought to be done quickly. I also do agree that we finally seem to be going towards a risk-based assessment of how we distribute federal dollars rather than purely population. I mean, to have it on a population basis makes little sense because some of the larger cities have the greatest threat against them, and it's important that they receive funds to be able to do what they need to do. I mean, obviously, you know, Merrimack, New Hampshire does not have the same threat profile as Washington, D.C. And if you do it on a per capita basis, you're just not meeting the threat.
You know, Senator Rudman, when I think about this issue, I wonder, though, you know, where does the spending stop? It seems like you can't possibly inspect every container, every airline bag, post guards at every subway. I mean, how do you prioritize? Because otherwise you just spend money endlessly.
No, you can't do that. What you have to do is you have to do a cost-benefit analysis, which the department is doing at this point, and decide where the money can be spent best. I mean, there's a great return at the ports where there are devices which can be employed to particularly spot radioactive materials being brought into the country illegally. That can be done at a relatively modest cost compared to the threat that poses. In terms of every subway, every train station, you just can't possibly do it.
You mentioned earlier, too, that you served on the Foreign Intelligence Advisory Committee with President Clinton. What's your assessment, Senator Rudman, of how the quality of our intelligence gathering has improved since 9/11? Again, that's been an enormous issue.
Yeah, well, I think, again, you have to understand that intelligence at very best is an art. It's not a science. You're basing your judgments on information from people who you think are reliable but who may not be. And a great example of that is the WMD issue that led to the Iraq War, which essentially that all intelligence agencies were dead flat wrong about. I think there is some improvement. I'm not sure the reorganization of the community has done it, but I think some of the people that are in place are very good people and moving in the right direction. But a lot needs to be done, and I'll tell you something else. You know, I have I'm fond of saying something about, you know, intelligence and terrorism, and what I essentially say is, you know, in baseball, if you batted 500 your first 2 years, you'd be in the Hall of Fame. In the intelligence business, if you're right 99.9% of the time, you're a loser.
Mm.
And people have to understand that.
Former U.S. Senator Warren Rudman is with us today on The Exchange. It's our 25 and 25 series. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. And Senator Rudman, let's go to Barrington now, where Fred is waiting. Hi, Fred. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning, Senator.
Morning, Fred.
Fred Coker.
Hey, Fred. How are you?
I was in my car listening to you, and I think the story of Pease and what you did to help transform that from a military base to what it is today is one of the best kept secrets in New Hampshire. What you convened in your office in Washington when you brought the Secretary of the Air Force and the head of EPA and the head of the Pease Development Authority, Henry Powers, into your office and closed the door and said, "We're not going to leave here until we have a solution."
Yeah, Fred, we forget. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, that was, of course, the pollution at Pease. It was a Superfund site, and of course, you can't develop a Superfund site, but you carved out a solution with those folks in your office, and it's a great story.
Well, and Fred, we forget how scary a time that was for New Hampshire and especially the Seacoast. What are we going to do with them closing down that that Air Force base?
Yeah, well, you all, I don't know if you know it, Laura, you know, Fred Coker was my chief of staff in New Hampshire.
Oh, that's great.
And it's nice of Fred to call. That was a historic achievement in many ways, and I'm not the only one who helped. A lot of people helped. But it was important that it was the first base that was going to be closed. It was right there on the list.
The first out of all of them during that whole base closure process.
That's right. With the very first BRAC process, Pease was number one on the list. And it should have been. It no longer served as a strategic air base. It was too close to the coast, too vulnerable. And I made it my business to make sure that we would develop that into something to be an economic engine for the seacoast. And one of the things I was able to do, convince the State Department to put their Northeast Visa Center at Pease. I'm sure you're aware that that is a major employer up there.
Yes.
Where visas are processed for the Northeast. Plus, doing some other things in terms of the transferring the ownership, getting the EPA to work out a solution on the pollution issues and to eventually make it what it is today, and that is in terms of the economy of Portsmouth, it's far greater than it was as an Air Force base.
Well, Senator Redmond, when you heard that Pease was number one on the base closure list, did you try at first to say, no, don't do this?
No, I didn't, because it was the right thing to do. I mean, when you're a United States Senator, you have to think of national security as well as your state. And Gordon Humphrey, who was my colleague at the time, we both agreed that you could not make a strong case to keep that base in terms of the technology. I used to say, you know, a Russian submarine could lob a hand grenade onto the runway, let alone a missile. I mean, it was just too close to the coast. It did not serve its purpose. It had many other possible uses, and I thought that our energies would be much better spent finding a way to have it come out on the other side as a strong, viable, economically productive facility rather than spend a lot of time fighting a battle which probably was going to lose. And we made the right choice.
Did you catch any flack from your constituents for that position?
Oh, sure.
Try harder, Senator. Keep it open.
Oh, listen, you take flack on everything. Look, if you're not willing to take flack, you ought to, you know, you ought to do something else. I mean, you know, run a men's store, run a gas station, practice law in Manchester. I mean, do whatever you want to do. If you want to accomplish anything in public life, unless you're willing to roll over every time somebody, you know, says a nasty word to you, then you ought not to be in this business. I mean, you've got to stand for what you believe in. If you don't do that, then frankly, you're not worth the. The office is too great for you, and you ought to leave. That's what I think.
How does what happened with Pease compare to the battle recently to save the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard? Or is there
That's
even
very
a comparison?
Different.
It is.
That's
All
very,
right.
very different. Very different. I mean, the Navy was flat out wrong on that, and every bit of information that came out showed that it was wrong, and the commission did the right thing. That is a very valuable asset. The Navy has very few yards left that it controls, and the nuclear submarine fleet is extremely important to the national security of the country. And that, you know, if they wanted to downsize it, that's one thing, but to eliminate it would have been a terrible, terrible mistake. And so, you know, we fought for that back then, and we won. And then this time, of course, thankfully, the delegations from New Hampshire and Maine were able to prevail. But I felt that that was a terrible mistake and said so publicly and did a few things to try to help reverse the outcome.
Today in the Exchange, our 25 and 25 series continues with former New Hampshire U.S. Senator Warren Rudman. And by the way, if you want more information about the series, you can go to nhpr.org. You can call in now with your questions, comments for Senator Rudman, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Let's go back to the phone, Senator Rudman, to Amherst, where Manny is on the phone. Hi, Manny, go ahead.
Good morning, Senator Rudman.
Morning.
Good morning.
First of all, I want to apologize to you.
For what?
I never voted for you.
well, there are a few people that didn't.
Yeah, I know. In retrospect, I probably should have. A comment, first of all, I think the work of the Concord Coalition is extraordinary, and I don't know how we can get that to work in other areas of the body politic. I mean, the stuff that passes for a dialogue between the two camps, so to speak, is pretty bad, you know. What you see on the cable news and so on. Is there any attempt, Senator Rudman, within the Concord Coalition to really reach out to the Republicans and the Democrats? I know, I'm sure there must be some, to just really stand up once and for all when they see something that is outrageous, like the hammer job that was done on Max Cleland during the campaign, I think it was 2004. You know, is there any attempt to say this is beyond the pale?
Well, Manny, and Senator Rudman, correct me if I'm wrong, Concord Coalition's really concerned with deficit reduction and entitlement reform.
That's right, Manny. I mean, you know, there someone has to deal with that, but not the coalition. The strength of the Concord Coalition, the reason it is so respected around the country, both by the people, by the media, and by many in Congress, is because it is very focused on the issue of the future of our children and our grandchildren and how we put the deficit in perspective. And if we started to dilute we would dilute our effectiveness if we worked in other areas. I mean, I am not arguing for a moment that that what you raise and the example you gave is an excellent example. I know Max very well. He's a friend of mine. That was outrageous. But that is not our mission. And you've got to be careful when you have a very focused mission with which you are identified that you don't take your eye off the ball. So that's something that we just can't do.
To Manny's broader issue, though, you know, every politician, every citizen you talk to alike moans about the nastiness of campaigns, slander of people. But so how come everybody keeps doing it if everybody says it's so bad?
Yeah, well, you know, I've always found that to be really fascinating. I mean, you hear people complaining bitterly about negative campaigning, and yet if you look at a number of selected campaigns around the country, it tends to work. So as long as people are going to believe this kind of business, then you're going to have it continue.
Manny, thanks for the question. Again, our number 1-800-892-6477. Senator Rudman, as I said, the whole theme of this series, 25 and 25, is celebrating our 25th birthday, talking to people who've been involved in the state for a long time. What strikes you the most, Senator Rudman, about how New Hampshire has changed in the past quarter century?
Well, that's an easy question for me to answer because I was kind of there at the beginning, so to speak, in 1980. In 1970, actually, the economic profile has changed enormously, and the demographic profile has changed. And I would just take a minute of your time, a little ancient history. The state owes former Governor Walter Peterson a great deal. I was his legal counsel in 1970 when he convened something called the Citizens Task Force, which totally reorganized the tax structure of the state of New Hampshire. The state of New Hampshire had something called a stock and trade tax, which meant that businesses, manufacturing businesses, retail businesses, automobile dealers, paid a tax every year on their capital assets. Therefore, the state had a very labor-intensive kind of an economy because companies that had high capital expenditures would not invest in New Hampshire because if they had a bad year, they still paid enormous taxes. The Citizens Task Force recommended, and Walter Peterson and his team put through the legislature in a special session in 1970, an enormous change in which we got the business profits tax and a number of other things and eliminated that. That, if you want to go back and track New Hampshire's high-tech growth and the truly great change in the economy of the state, it dates back to that time. And I see a state today, which is very diverse in terms of its economy, has a lot of intellectual capacity amongst high-tech companies, and a demographic in which people are better educated and better informed. So I see a very different state. Now, I also think the state has become probably more balanced in terms of Republican, Democrat, and Independent over the last 25 years, which is not surprising considering the migration to New Hampshire that we've seen.
So one tax change changed the whole economy, and in so doing, changed the demographics, changed the kind of cultural profile of New Hampshire?
Yeah, Walter Peterson has never received the credit that he richly deserves for that. You go talk to people. I'll tell you an interesting story. The automobile dealers who had their great inventories on the borders near Vermont, Massachusetts, since April 1 was the day you had to declare, they would move their vehicles somewhat illegally, but they did it, to other parts of New England, so they could not be counted in their inventory for the day that taxes were assessed. And manufacturing companies were having a terrible hard time. We're getting taxed on their machinery, their inventory, and people would not invest. That was the turning point, and that was the major recommendation of the Citizens Task Force amongst 40 or 50 major recommendations. And the attorney in Concord, who you probably know, Martin Gross.
Mm-hmm.
Martin Gross,
a founder of NHPR.
Right, Martin Gross came in as kind of my assistant, and I was legal counsel of Walter Peterson, and we essentially lobbied the legislature for that special session to get these proposals enacted. And to me, that one act of the legislature changed the economic profile and the demographic profile of the state of New Hampshire. It's truly fascinating, and I would hope that some university professor someplace would sit down, really study what happened in 1970, and write a book about it, because it's a great story.
And I take it the demographic changes, the economic changes, you find largely favorable. I mean, people always complain about the growth in New Hampshire. It's too much and so forth.
Well, look, there are places that I think could do a better job of controlling growth. I think some of the zoning in places has been spotty. I don't think we have to look like northern New Jersey, and we do in some places. But nonetheless, on balance, the state and its population are well-served, and young people in the state have a much better opportunity to stay in the state and get meaningful employment in the state than they did 25 years ago. You know, there were many changes that came in New Hampshire from the 50s on. The two largest ones were the loss of the textile industry and the loss of the shoe industry. And the state was in very tough economic times back in the 50s and the early 60s. And it was only in 1970 with these major changes that the state's profile started to change, and all the high-tech companies that came to New Hampshire started to move in because they were capital-intensive. They dealt with intellectual property, and those were things which they didn't have to worry about paying taxes on every April 1st, irrespective of business conditions. So, Walter Peterson's been an inspiration to me. He was a great governor. He got defeated because he stood up for what he thought was right on taxation, but what he did with that particular law changed the whole profile of New Hampshire.
Let's go back to our caller, Senator Rudman, again. The number 1-800-892-6477 to Jackson. And Joyce joins us from there. Hi, Joyce. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning. I'd like to ask Senator Rudman to talk about his efforts to secure nuclear weapons around the world.
Secure meaning make them safe.
Make them. Apparently, there are a lot of rogue weapons, or mm-hmm. they're not secured in many countries. And I know he's made great effort to try to make them more secure.
And this was especially an issue after the fall of the Soviet Union in the late 80s. Senator Rudman, please.
Well, I've worked in that area with a number of organizations and people. My good friend Sam Nunn, who is the author with Senator Lugar of the Nunn-Lugar Amendment, which provides funds for going around the world and getting these weapons and this weapons-grade material and putting it in safe places. I've been very supportive of that. I've worked with Sam on his private initiative, which Ted Turner set up, which is a private nuclear threat initiative, and done some, you know, some public speaking, some television programs and things of that sort. And I think it's very important because, you know, we've got an awful lot of loose nukes around the world, and you never know whose hands they're going to get into. And that, of course, is something that we have to be concerned about in terms of terrorism against not only us, but many of our friends.
And to Barnstead next, where Julia has been waiting. Hi, Julia. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning, sir. First, I'd like to say Warren Redman for president.
Well, I have my. I'm much too sane for that.
Go ahead, Julia.
Same for the country, sir. I would like to ask you about our school funding crisis and what you think of the tax structure in New Hampshire and what changes need to be made.
Good question,
well,
Julia.
You know,
what do you think?
We could spend the entire morning on that. I do not support changing the state constitution to limit the authority of the Supreme Court. I think that's a very slippery slope. I do think there are a number of proposals in the legislature that I'm aware of and I'm not intimately aware of that can have a solution here. I believe a solution must be reached. I know the governor is supporting it, and I'm very fond of him. I think he's been a good governor, opposite party, but a good governor. I know he supports a constitutional amendment, I believe, from what I read. I don't, because I think changing the state constitution is something you do only in extraordinary circumstances when you have no other alternatives, and I think there are other alternatives. There is no question the legislature must define what an adequate education is. There is great debate about that, and my hope is that they can define that during the session and hopefully not get to a situation where the state Supreme Court has to start doing things that legislatures ought to be doing in the first instance.
Julie asked about New Hampshire's rather unique tax structure, lack of a broad-based sales or income tax. What's your position, Senator Rudman, on that structure and, you know, whether it's a good idea or not?
Well, it has worked because one of the things that you look at is you look at states around us that have those taxes, and you look at the quality of life there, their education of the children, and you look at the whole combination of things, and you really wonder whether or not the money has been properly spent. I'll tell you what my position has always been, that before you could ever pass a broad-based tax in New Hampshire, you would have to have a now I believe that this is a place for a constitutional amendment, that any money raised there, like the gas tax, goes to highways. That's what the state constitution says. I believe that if you're going to have a broad-based tax, you've got to make sure the legislature cannot squander that money. That money has to go directly on a formula basis to the cities and towns to support education, period. That is something that I probably could support. But without that amendment, I would not favor those taxes.
Julia, thanks for that call. And Senator Rudman, we've covered so many of the issues that you've worked on over the past 25 years, but you just recently attached your name to yet another issue. You've signed on as honorary chair for Americans for Campaign Reform. That's John Rouse Group, lobbying for voluntary public funding of campaigns. Now, you said that
Along with Alan Simpson, former colleague of mine from Wyoming, and Bob Kerry, and Bill Bradley.
Well, you said that this is not something you originally favored. How did you change your mind?
Well, I'll tell you, it's been an evolution on my part. I was not for public finance, but frankly, with all of the scandals I've seen and all of the money involved in politics today and where that money comes from, I am absolutely convinced that the American people are very suspicious of the Congress, even though the overwhelming majority of members of Congress, House and Senate, are honest, hardworking, decent people. Nonetheless, with all of this money around, the average American believes that the Congress is bought and paid for by special interests. And if you have a lack of confidence in your government, you cannot get things done. You can't possibly address the issues that we face in this 21st century. And for that reason, I have reluctantly come to the conclusion that public financing is probably the only way out.
Reluctantly.
Reluctantly.
Why reluctantly?
Well, because I have always believed that people ought to be able to express themselves both with speech and with contributions to political candidates, and I always found that to be okay. But looking at the effect, I've decided that, unfortunately, it just isn't working. Now, I know there are many people who disagree with me, many good friends disagree with me, but I am fearful that it's going to get worse, not better, in terms of how the American people view their elected government. And I think that is the real danger, and that is why I've changed my position.
One last question for you, Senator Rudman, and I so appreciate your time and you joining us for this series. Where do you think New Hampshire should put its energies, cultural, economic, in the next 25 years?
My own view is that there are two issues that are vital for New Hampshire to continue the quality of life that we have. Number one, we have to continue to fight hard to protect the environment of our state, to make sure that that environment, which is so pristine and so beautiful, is kept the way it is, and that with all due respect to business interests, that there be a balance between development and the environment. And secondly, I think it's extraordinarily important that we continue to upgrade education of our young people right from kindergarten, you know, through high school and our state university and our Voc Tech system. I think we've got to have major improvements and a broadening of our educational outline so that young people in New Hampshire have the same opportunity for growth and for the kind of life they want that people have in states that have, you know, first-rate systems. Our system's pretty good, but it can have some improvement. That's what some of the fight is about concerning this whole question of funding. But I think that education and environment are the two number one issues facing the state of New Hampshire.
And you've talked a lot about your love for the natural environment. I'm just curious, Senator Redmond, what's your favorite place in New Hampshire?
Well, you know, I have a lot of wonderful memories of Lake Sunapee and that whole region, because when my children were young, we used to go up and water ski and do some boating and fishing. And the Sunapee region, I've always loved that whole area of the state, as well as the White Mountains. But, you know, it's pretty hard to pick a favorite. There's so many great places to be.
Well, Senator Redmond, thank you again for joining us today and participating in this 25 and 25 series. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Laura.
Former New Hampshire U.S. Senator Warren Rudman, a Republican who served 12 years in the U.S. Senate. For more information again on 25 and 25, go to nhpr.org. You can see who's coming up next. You can also chime in on who would make your 25 and 25 list. Again, the address is nhpr.org. And by the way, next in the series is New Hampshire Episcopal Bishop Gene Robinson. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The producer, Ty Fraley. The engineer, Dan Colgan. Our intern, Caitlin Rookie. Our volunteer, Priscilla Malcolm. Our new theme music was composed by Bob Lord, performed by the group Dreadnought. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Laura Kanoy.